From Washington, this is VOA News. Gunmen attack an army post in Mali. Several rebel bases are seized in the DRC. I'm Dave DeForest reporting from Washington. Five people died when gunmen attacked an army post in central Mali. The attack happened overnight in Nampala near the border with Mauritania. A city official says three Malian soldiers and two gunmen were killed. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but suspicion fell on Al-Qaeda militants who are active in the region. Military sources tell AFP several rebel bases have been seized in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo. The bases of the Burundi rebel group, the National Liberation Forces, were taken during an operation by DRC and United Nations forces. Lieutenant Colonel Felix Prosper Basse said the bases were located near the Burundi border in South Kivu. The AFP reports U.S. prosecutors today charged two men with conspiracy to overthrow the government of Gambia. The Justice Department says Papa Faal and Cherno Ngai were arrested in the United States after they returned from Gambia. U.S. officials say the two had been in Gambia to help launch a coup against President Yahya Jammeh. The men are charged with conspiracy to violate the Neutrality Act, which prohibits U.S. citizens or residents from taking up arms or plotting against nations at peace with the United States. The Associated Press quotes fleeing civilians as saying the Islamist group Boko Haram has seized a key base in Nigeria near the nation's border with Chad. The witnesses report that the rebels overwhelmed a multinational military force and took the base in the town of Baga. This is VOA News. The AFP News Service quotes a tribal leader as saying 13 captive Christians from Egypt have been freed in Libya. The Christians had been reported by the government to have been abducted by Islamic militants, although there were conflicting reports about the identity of the captors. Mufta Marzug, the head of the Council of Elders in the city of Sirte, said the town elders negotiated the release of the 13. He did not say anything about another seven Christians believed to be held, and he gave no details about the reported release. The Associated Press reports that Libyan House Speaker Agila Issa has come out against any Western military intervention in his country. He told reporters in Cairo today his government will seek military help only from Arab nations and only if it is needed. He spoke on the sidelines of an Arab League meeting. Meanwhile, French President Francois Hollande is ruling out unilateral military intervention in Libya. Indonesian officials have suspended several aviation officials in the wake of the crash of Air Asia Flight 8501. The suspensions followed the revelation that the plane did not have the proper permits to fly the day it went down in the Java Sea. Saudi officials say a suicide bomber has killed two border guards and their commanding officer in an attack near the Iraqi border. The Interior Ministry said the attack today in Arar began when people began shooting at a border patrol. Russian dissident Alexei Navalny says he will not comply with the terms of his house arrest. The Reuters news agency quotes him as saying he has removed his monitoring tag. Navalny was found guilty of embezzling money and given a suspended sentence December 30th. 3 years ago, he led protests against the government of Vladimir Putin. This from the AFP. There is increased political tension and violence in Bangladesh on the anniversary of an election last year that was boycotted by the opposition. Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina's ruling Awami League Party said it would hold rallies to celebrate the anniversary, but members of the opposition Bangladesh Nationalist Party planned counter demonstrations. The Prime Minister today accused opposition leader Khaled Azia of trying to foment anarchy in the country and blamed the BNP party chief for a wave of violence that has left at least four people dead. Ms. Zia, in turn, accused the Prime Minister of clinging to power by force. Reuters reports that authorities today cut off transportation into the capital, Dhaka, amid the violence. On Wall Street, U.S. stock indexes are down at this hour. European markets are also down. Asia-Pacific markets were mixed at the close of trade today. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehis Wuhiben coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Boko Haram fighters overpowered Nigerian soldiers Saturday at a military base in the far northeastern town of Baga, forcing residents and soldiers to flee. The military has not issued a statement about the attack, but sources tell VOA that Boko Haram has full control of the town.
That's VOA's Ann Look reporting. Details coming up.
Also, two U.S. citizens are facing charges for their alleged role in last week's coup attempt in the West African nation of Gambia. And unrest on the border with Nigeria has disrupted the education of thousands of young people in Cameroon.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily feature. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, two U.S. citizens are facing charges for their alleged role in last week's coup attempt in the Gambia. The U.S. Justice Department says 57-year-old Cherno Njai and 46-year-old Papa Fall are both in custody in the United States and will make their initial court appearances today. Both men are charged with conspiracy to violate the U.S. Neutrality Act, as well as a firearms charge. According to the Justice Department, Njai and Fall traveled to the Gambia in December with the purpose of overthrowing the government. They returned to the U.S. after a December 30th coup attempt failed. U.S. justice officials say the conspirators expected that Njai would have served as Gambia's interim leader if the plot to overthrow President Yahya Jammeh succeeded.
Boko Haram fighters have overpowered Nigerian soldiers at a military base in the far northern eastern town of Baga, forcing residents and soldiers to flee. The military has not issued a statement about Saturday's attack, but sources tell VOA that Boko Haram has full control of the town. VOA's Ann Look has the story with reporting in Maiduguri by Abdul Karim Haruna.
Boko Haram overran Baga after attacking a nearby village. One survivor told VOA that, quote, hundreds of insurgents rode into Baga on vehicles and motorbikes, some throwing explosives. They set fire to buildings. There was a fierce firefight. Soldiers resisted, quote, for hours, said an intelligence official in Maiduguri. But that source told VOA that without reinforcements, soldiers could not hold the town. Insurgents had blocked the main roads in or out. Residents fled into the bush or headed for Lake Chad to hop in canoes or try to swim away. Some drowned. Other residents were shot or injured. The number of dead and wounded is not known. A fisherman who got away told VOA that some soldiers were peeling off their uniforms and begging for civilian clothes. He said they appeared to have run out of ammunition. Baga is part of Senator Mena Maajilawin's district in Borno State. Baga is also his hometown.
They attacked the place by around between 5 and 6 in the morning. By 9, it was all over.
Senator Lawin said local and state authorities had informed the military of the Boko Haram threat in the area.
We were informed their locations and so on and so forth. Reports were made. I don't know. The ease with which it fell is really, really very, very, very disappointing.
There has been no official response to the attack. In the past, government officials have insisted the war covers a vast territory in the northeast and said the military cannot be everywhere at once. Boko Haram is known to attack military bases to resupply and rearm. But hoisting their black flag over Baga also struck a symbolic blow. The town sits on Lake Chad, whose waters straddle the borders of Nigeria, Niger, Cameroon, and Chad. The military base there was the nominal headquarters for a four-country joint task force set up last year to combat trafficking and terrorism. It appears only Nigerian troops were manning the base when it was attacked. Security analysts told VOA that the loss of Baga raises renewed concerns about the military's level of morale and preparedness. Soldiers in the northeast have complained they do not have adequate gear and ammunition to fight the insurgents. Local media report military tribunals have sentenced at least 70 soldiers to death for mutiny and refusing to fight. More are reportedly awaiting trial. Ann Look, VOA News, Dakar.
Unrest on the border with Nigeria has disrupted the education of thousands of young people in Cameroon. Many Cameroonian schools on the border with Nigeria's Borno State remained closed as other schools in the country reopened today after the Christmas vacation. Some of the schools were either destroyed by Boko Haram fighters or the Cameroon Air Force when they bombarded villages and towns that had been seized by suspected Boko Haram fighters last week. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
Mbani Wilson, an official of Cameroon's Ministry of Basic Education in northern Cameroon, says thousands of teachers, students and pupils have fled schools located along the Cameroonian border with Nigeria's Borno State due to bloody confrontations between the Cameroon military and suspected militants of the Nigerian terrorist group Boko Haram.
It's a very difficult situation for learners and teachers as many of the schools, especially of the basic education sector, have been closed down. You see, a number of schools have been closed down. We face the attacks of Boko Haram and the constant fear of surprises.
19-year-old Fopa Faison, now an Upper Sixth student of the government's high school Marua in northern Cameroon, says he escaped when Cameroon's Air Force destroyed his old school on the border with Nigeria.
Praying that things should change so that we can still live our life here. Security has been really difficult. It has been very, very difficult for us.
Fopa's uncle, Alain Gaupwe, who also escaped from Ashigasha with his four children, says their school and huge portions of their town were destroyed by rockets launched by Cameroon's Air Force against suspected Boko Haram fighters who had occupied the area.
Nous allons continuer à travailler. Nous faisons confiance à nos hommes.
He says they still have confidence in the Cameroon military that is working to secure their home areas. Meanwhile, he says they expect their children to cope in their new environments. Maimunatu Farida, a student from Government Bilingual High School Marua in Cameroon, says their classrooms are now congested with students fleeing the assaults in the border areas near Nigeria.
Nous restons solidaires avec nos camarades qu'ils pensent à leur avenir et donc ils doivent.
She says their peers from the war zone should be courageous as they prepare their future in their new schools. Last week, Cameroon said its military had launched rockets on at least 1,000 suspected Boko Haram fighters who attacked a military base in the border area of Amchide and seized a huge portion of Cameroon's town of Ashigasha and a number of villages. In a telephone interview with VOA, journalist Samuel Sawada, who is based in northern Cameroon, says the affected areas are being deserted by the residents.
Many schools in areas that border on Nigeria in from Lake Chad to the locality of Buha in the Maritanaga have been closed down. People have deserted and are still deserting to find refuge in the hinterland. And the families that actually could afford it have transferred their children to safer areas in the hinterland.
Nigeria and Cameroon report that thousands of people have been killed and hundreds of thousands displaced by Boko Haram's five-year-old uprising to create an Islamic state in northern Nigeria. Moki Edwin Kinzika, VOA News, Yaoundé.
Gunmen suspected to be Al-Qaeda militants have killed at least five people in a town in central Mali. Officials in Mali say fighters on motorbikes stormed the town of Nampala before dawn today. The town is located about 530 kilometers northeast of the capital Bamako and near the border with Mauritania. Initial reports say some of those killed were Malian soldiers. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but suspicion fell on Al-Qaeda militants who are active in the region. Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb and allied groups seized control of northern Mali in 2012 before being ousted by a French-led military force.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
A I'm Yehiz Huhib, 15 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Two U.S. citizens are facing charges for their alleged role in last week's coup attempt in the Western African nation of Gambia. And Boko Haram fighters have overpowered Nigerian soldiers at a military base in the far northeastern town of Baga, forcing residents and soldiers to flee. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The condition of a Scottish nurse who's being treated for Ebola has deteriorated. Pauline Kafferke is at the Royal Free Hospital in London. Kafferke had volunteered at an Ebola treatment center in Kerrytown, Sierra Leone. She was diagnosed with the virus when she returned to Glasgow by plane a week ago. The 39-year-old nurse is being treated with an antiviral drug. Rob McGillivray of Save the Children says the NGO is investigating how she became infected and identifying others who may have been exposed at the Sierra Leone clinic. The clinic was built by British Army Royal Engineers and opened in early November. Meanwhile, a U.S. health worker who was exposed to the Ebola virus in Sierra Leone arrived yesterday at the Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha. She is there for observation. A hospital official says the unidentified worker is not ill and is not contagious. However, she will remain in a specialized biocontainment unit for 21 days.
Also, South Korean medic has been flown to Germany for observation after being exposed to Ebola in Sierra Leone. He was treating a patient at the time. As of last week, the World Health Organization reported that more than 8,000 people have died of the Ebola virus. Almost all of the deaths occurred in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea. Also, a member of the U.S. Congress says it's time for the U.S. government to change its Ebola strategy in Liberia. Senator Chris Coons has just returned from a four-day inspection of the U.S. role in fighting Ebola in Liberia. He praised the work of 2,400 U.S. troops serving there, but he says the crisis is now being managed well, so he will urge President Barack Obama to let Liberians take control of the anti-Ebola campaign. Coons is chairman of the Senate Subcommittee on African Affairs.
Well, the World Health Organization recently called for 900 more epidemiologists to join the battle against Ebola in West Africa. That's triple the current number. Epidemiologists study the patterns of disease outbreaks to determine how they spread and where they may go next. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Upon hearing the WHO announcement regarding epidemiologists, Dr. Rossi Hassad said, "It's about time." Hassad is an epidemiologist himself and a professor at Mercy College in New York.
An epidemiologist is a healthcare professional who is concerned with the distribution and determinants of diseases in a community. They operate at the population level rather than the individual or clinical level. They are investigators, or what we call detectives of medicine, and they focus largely on intelligence, data about morbidity, mortality, meaning illness, death, and symptoms.
The information they gather is used to create a geographical map and timeline of the outbreak. Epidemiologists, though, do not treat patients.
So an epidemiologist will be analyzing data, would be presenting data, will be using various algorithms to help to explain and predict where symptoms are occurring and what we might see next. So it's largely analytical work that an epidemiologist does.
An algorithm is used in math and computer science. It's described as a step-by-step procedure for calculations. Hassad said epidemiologists are a necessity in the fight against Ebola. He says there's a saying regarding infectious diseases: a case anywhere is a risk everywhere.
With Ebola, a single case can reignite an epidemic, and you need every contact from every case. And it's good old-fashioned epidemiology that helps us define those contacts and properly assess them.
He says epidemiologists pay strict attention to psychosocial and sociocultural factors and dynamics. One of the most important things they will do, he says, is set up a comprehensive surveillance system.
We have had a huge focus on the clinical component of this epidemic. And what that does is it doesn't interrupt the chain of transmission. So you have a steady flow of cases with a huge focus on treatment.
Besides being critical of the initial slow response to the outbreak, Assad says there has been a lack of collaboration between the clinical and public health arms of medicine.
At times, the information and narrative that we have heard and seen suggested one of competition, protection of turf, rather than collaboration and cooperation. And I hope that for 2015 and beyond, we could improve on that.
Similar complaints of a lack of cooperation and openness were heard during the earlier years of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. Dr. Assad praises the current fast-tracking of Ebola research.
Ebola has been with us for 40 years, and as we all know, the lack of action or the inaction over the years was largely because of a lack of financial or economic incentive to move along pharmaceutical research and production. Now, I think the huge threat that this epidemic poses will motivate governments to support. I think we will see that.
However, he says, he's not sure that an effective vaccine will be ready in time to have a major effect on the epidemic. The outbreak, however, could result in better overall health care for Africans.
I do believe that the magnitude of the current epidemic will be a huge motivating factor to get projects moving along to improve the healthcare infrastructure of West Africa. Sustaining it will be another concern.
Dr. Assad warns the lack of emphasis given to epidemiology in the Ebola outbreak until now could mean it will continue through most of the year. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The international humanitarian NGO Norwegian Refugee Council warns that the dire situation for refugees in hot spots around the world, such as Syria and Central African Republic, will become more desperate in 2015. The group says unless G8 countries and emerging rich countries do more at the negotiating table and put more people on the ground to provide protection, millions more civilians will die. Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, provided insight into the challenges providing humanitarian operations for refugees in 2015.
Well, I sincerely hope that 2015 will be better than the horrors of 2014, which was the worst year for refugees and internally displaced that I can remember in my more than 30 years as a humanitarian worker. What I fear is that 2015 may become even worse, in particular in the most horrendous refugee situation that we've had worldwide since the Second World War, really, and that is Syria. In Syria and in the neighboring countries, there are now more than 10 million refugees and displaced. And we're not coping. This year is starting with the news that Lebanon basically says it's over. We cannot accept more Syrians. And that means that Syrians are now trapped inside that horrendous war.
With people trapped, as you say, and left homeless, where do we go from here? What is the next step?
Well, the next step is that the rest of the world does what it should. We need to help protect people in the kind of a situation that the Syrians now are in. It's the worst horrors, it's the worst humanitarian and human rights challenge on our watch. It's the worst since the genocides of the 1990s. So I would hope that the G8 countries, or for that matter, the Security Council powers, behave like great powers and step up to the plate and work to build a real solidarity with Syrians inside Syria and in the neighboring countries, no country is really investing commensurately to what this humanitarian challenge is. No country is receiving, outside of the region, is receiving refugees as we should. In short, we're watching people now dying in the Mediterranean as they desperately try to flee from the situation.
In looking at the continent of Africa, we see in Central African Republic a large number of refugees in this country as well and displaced people. What are the biggest challenges you see there for 2015?
Well, one of the challenges in the Central African Republic, but also in South Sudan, is to be able to revive some hope that we can get out of the vicious cycle. It's overshadowed by what's happening in the Middle East. But of course, for those between 1 and 2 million directly affected as war victims in the Central African Republic and the same amount of people at least in South Sudan, it's a question of us being there with them, being more present there, getting the peacekeeping operation to start to pacify areas, not letting the warlords have a free rein. Central African Republic, it's Muslim against Christian, Christian against Muslim. The thugs are taking over and women and children die. And it shouldn't be like that in 2015.
Until countries are able to resolve some of these conflicts in their countries, what are the biggest needs of the people who are caught up in the conflict? What are their needs going to be for 2015?
The biggest needs of the people are, number one, protection. I mean, we need to be there where they suffer, where they are attacked. Women and children are particularly vulnerable, and it is horrendous to hear and see what's still happening. Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Nigeria and Pakistan have 80% of all terror worldwide. Terror is not there in Norway, nor in the United States, nor in the other Western countries. We talk about it constantly. We spend multi-billion dollars in airport controls and whatnot, but the people are dying, bleeding, and suffering in the few countries that I mentioned. So why couldn't we be more present there with aid workers, with human rights workers, with peace workers, with diplomats, with political initiatives, with sanctions?
A lot of the international community is saying that financially they are just strapped and providing resources to these situations.
Remember last year, World Food Program had to cut rations for refugee children in half in some places. The relief organizations do not have enough resources. So how come that military spending is going through the roof in so many countries, that we can do hundreds of billions of dollars in military operations, and we cannot afford the $1 or $2 or $3 billion that are needed for the humanitarian operations in many places?
That was Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. He spoke with me from Oslo, Norway.
South African park rangers killed two suspected rhino poachers today at Kruger National Park. A park spokesman says the patrol encountered three men who shot at the rangers. The rangers returned fire, killing two men. One escaped. In the past 12 months, more than 1,000 rhinos in South Africa have been slaughtered by poachers. This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Boko Haram fighters overpower Nigerian soldiers at a military base in the far northeastern town of Baga, forcing residents and soldiers to flee. And the unrest on the border with Nigeria has disrupted the education of thousands of young people in Cameroon. Coming up, we'll have music from Ghana and in our feature segment, the first part of a series focusing on palliative caregivers in South Africa. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have lots and lots of Africa Cup of Nations football news for us.
Kim, we're now only 12 days away to the kickoff of the Africa Cup of Nations football tournament in Equatorial Guinea. The host country will play Congo Brazzaville January 17th in the opening match in the port city of Bata. In match two that same day, also in Bata, Gabon will go against Burkina Faso. With the competition just around the corner, the qualified teams are continuing their preparations for the African Championship Tournament. South Africa, the 1996 Nations Cup champion, warmed up with a victory over the 2012 winner. Marco Uma reports from Johannesburg.
A goal scored by winger Thuso Pala in the 81st minute lifted hosts South Africa to a 1-0 victory over Zambia in an Orange Africa Cup of Nations build-up match at the Orlando Stadium in Soweto, South Africa on Sunday. Despite the narrow loss, Zambia's coach Ona Janza is optimistic about his team's prospect at the Nations Cup, which starts on the 17th of January.
Going by our last three games, I think we were so aggressive going towards the opponent's goal mouth. But in today's game, of course, maybe we didn't attempt so much going forward. We tried to make amends on the second striker. We wanted to see what Chisamba can do as a second striker from the deep midfield. Today's game was a good eye-opener for us to know where we stand. As a team, we didn't do a lot of striking. And the unfortunate situation is that even obvious chances that came our way, we did not utilize. I think we had we were the first to have a clear-cut chance. I think Jackson Mwanza was in front of the goal, which was almost yawning.
Zambia won the cup in 2012 in Gabon and Equatorial Guinea, a very sentimental victory given the history of tragedy that took place there. Have you set any target for the competition?
I, for one, as a coach, there's nothing that I would love in my career than paying my country the best reward, like giving them the cup. Of course, I have to, again, focus on the players themselves. With the branding of new players and old players, the mileage of expectation, of course, may be too high for them to think about winning the cup. But to them, the target will be to come out of the group stage as the best two. Maybe go to the quarterfinals, struggle, go to the semifinals. But that will be for the players. But for me as a coach, to be in the finals. So I think if the cup will go to Zambia, it shouldn't be a surprise because we are ready for.
That was Ona Janza, coach of Zambia. Mark Omer in Johannesburg, South Africa.
Because this is Africa. Zamina, mina, waka, waka, Zamina, mina, sakalewa. This time for Africa.
I'm very, 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 very excited. Because
this is Africa. Zamina, mina, waka, waka, Zamina, mina, sakalewa. This time for Africa.
With more Africa Cup of Nations football news, here is the VOA's Nightline Africa sportsman, Shegun Dot, on the spot at Yemi.
Happy New Year to all our listeners across Africa. With the championship fast approaching, the host nation has fired coach Andoni Goikotia, plunging his preparations into chaos. Goikotia departed on Thursday after the election of a new president for the Equatorial Guinea Football Federation, known as FEGUIFOOT. New Federation President André Mbomio confirmed the sacking of the former Spanish international, who had been in charge for the last 2 years, but gave no reasons. Failure in the recent regional competition for the Equatorial Guinea side plus defeat in two warm-up games in Portugal last week likely triggered the sack of the coach. Equatorial Guinea, which last month stepped in as emergency host of the Nations Cup in place of Morocco, has been preparing for the tournament in Portugal. The host will play Congo in the opening game of the 16-nation tournament in Bata on January 17th. Also in Equatorial Guinea's group are Burkina Faso and Gabon. Talking about preparations, the Black Stars of Ghana on Saturday officially kick-started their preparations for the Nations Cup. The team trained in Ghana's capital, Accra. Captain Asamoah Gyan and 24 other players who had been involved in informal training sessions during their holidays were all available. The training was the final send-off for the Black Stars, who traveled to Spain to continue with their preparations. Newly appointed fitness trainer Jamie Lawrence got the day's workout started when he led the players through fitness exercises. Coach Avram Grant and assistant Maxwell Konadu took charge of the session. Ghana is in a tough Group C at the 38th edition of the two-yearly Nations Cup, alongside Senegal, South Africa, and Algeria. Also, the Algerian national football team on Friday began preparations for the tournament. As part of the preparations, Algeria will play a friendly match against Tunisia in Tunis on January 11th before flying to Equatorial Guinea 4 days later. Algeria is in the so-called group of death with Ghana, South Africa, and Senegal. And from Mali comes the report that giant striker Cheikh Diabaté requires a knee operation and will be out for 4 months, meaning he will miss the Africa Cup of Nations. The 26-year-old Diabaté, who is playing professionally in France, agreed to undergo surgery after a consultation with a specialist in Marseille last month. Diabaté, who stands at an imposing 1.94 meters, had been called up for Mali for the Cup of Nations. However, he had been complaining of recurring problems with his knee for several months. Meanwhile, Mali has called up forward Mohamed Traoré to replace Diabaté. Traoré plays for the top Sudanese club, Al Merrikh. Mali is in Group D at the Nations Cup alongside Ivory Coast, Cameroon, and Guinea.
Hi, this is VOA's Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. You're listening to my friend Shagun Dot on the spot at Adeyemi.
Thank you, Sonny, and Happy New Year to you. Well, as the final countdown to the opening of the three-week tournament continues, several teams have started naming their final squads. According to African Soccer's governing body, CAF, all the 16 finalists must submit their final 23-member squads by midnight on Wednesday, January 7th. Any nation that fails to meet the CAF deadline will be fined, in addition to having its player allocation reduced to 22. Among the teams that have already beaten the deadline is South Africa. In naming his team, coach Ephraim Cheikh Mashaba surprisingly left out Ajax Amsterdam's midfielder, Tulani Serero. Mashaba said he omitted Serero from the 23-member squad because, quote, other players were better than him, unquote. Ivory Coast has also named its final squad. Coach Avi Renard named Nations Cup veterans and familiar faces, such as Captain Yaya Toure and elder brother Kolo, Jevinho, Salomon Kalou, Boubacar Barry, and Cheikh Tiote in his final squad. The Elephants of Ivory Coast will open an 11-day training on Monday in Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates, in preparation for the championship. Ivory Coast is in Group D with Mali, Cameroon, and Guinea. Well, as I reported last week, one team that will be watching the 2015 Nations Cup finals on television is Nigeria, which is the defending champion. The Super Eagles of Nigeria failed to qualify for the Equatorial Guinea tournament, to the disappointment of many football fans. Among them is former Super Eagles captain, Nwankwo Kanu. Kanu told the football website Goal.com that 2014 was a disappointing year for Nigerian football because of the Eagles' failure to qualify for the Nations Cup. If we are not featuring among the best countries in Africa that will participate in the 2015 AFCON, that is the Nations Cup, it simply means that something went wrong with our football in 2014, he says. Echoing Kanu is a Nigerian parliamentarian and football enthusiast, Ogbonna Nwoke. Nwoke says Nigeria would be sorely missed at the 2015 Nations Cup finals.
But I think the world will miss Nigeria's absence. I think the Africans themselves will miss Nigeria's absence. We'll bring a great some difference to the game. the way we play, the way we celebrate, even the way we sing when the game is on. And I think the world will miss that definitely. I think the African world will be wondering how come a former champion, just champion of the game in South Africa, suddenly fizzles out when it matters most. That's the game. It's always, like we say in sports, let the best win.
He also speaks on what needs to be done to raise the standard of football in Nigeria.
We need to lay appropriate foundations. It's just not enough for us to depend on our boys who have been tutored abroad by foreign coaches. I believe the time has come to fully establish Nigerian league. The time has come to for coaches here to look further inwards. There are talents everywhere. Those who are playing abroad began their play at home. They were not made abroad. And so if we work hard, if we remove politics from football, if we bring in proper football administrators, not just opportunists that are beginning to gravitate in the direction of the football house, then we can put Nigeria's football back on track.
That was Nigerian parliamentarian Ugbonna Nwoke commenting on the absence of the Super Eagles of Nigeria from the 2015 Nations Cup finals in Equatorial Guinea. He spoke with reporter Tony Tamuno in Port Harcourt. Finally, the stage is set for the 2014 Glocaf Awards, the annual extravaganza that celebrates the best in African football. The 2014 edition will be held in Nigeria's commercial city of Lagos on Thursday, January 8th. The awards gala will see players and officials who have distinguished themselves during the year 2014, receiving honors for their achievements. Winners of the prestigious African Player of the Year, as well as for 15 other categories, will be unveiled during the gala night. Some of the other categories are African Player of the Year, based in Africa, National Team of the Year, Club of the Year, Referee of the Year, and Coach of the Year. Africa's Finest 11 will also be revealed on the night that will be attended by the creme de la creme of the continent's football icons. Ivorian midfielder Yaya Toure was named the African Player of the Year for the third time at the last edition held on January 9, 2014, also here in Lagos. Toure has also been named in the three-man shortlist for the 2014 award, meaning he has a chance to clinch a record fourth consecutive African Footballer of the Year title. Thanks so much for listening. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Thanks, Segun, and Happy New Year to you also, buddy. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny. If you check out my Facebook page, you'll see a photo of me with VOA director David Ensor, taken by my trusty engineer this evening, Bill Werkinger. Yeah, Bill. I'm VOA Sunny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Okay, thank you, Sunny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of The Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Coming up, the first part of a series focusing on palliative caregivers in South Africa and next, access to technology in the poorest slum in Nairobi. But first, some music. Here is Mr. Oduro of Ghana with Abibaye.
Mayada, Macheke. Mayada, Macheke. Mayada, Macheke. Mayada,
Abibaye.
Mayada,
Abibaye.
Mayada,
Abibaye.
Dance more. to Connie Hurst. Yeah, report draw. And through NTRP and DC law. Yeah, yeah, Clinton, yeah, the Yako High Court. President Sequoia, and to see so. You and you are. Give me some more. The dead, that's a tea pump, and it's raw. To start with the Ghana, yeah, win the raw. Defend this or take off for any football. You watch the DNC, me pimp support. Miss Lamina, so. Take tall. No, be no commentary. Yeah, be a blow. Grab your grab, and your draw. And see your rubber, put on, put off. Miss Abiba, try hardcore. Ace, 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 ace. One, pretty
Abiba, hey, Abiba. Abiba, hey.
Ghana's Mr. Oduro with Abibaye.
Well, they're South Africa's invisible health heroes, the people who care for patients dying of incurable illnesses. In a country with high rates of cancer, heart disorders, and infectious diseases such as AIDS and tuberculosis, the demand for their care is high. They ease the emotional, physical, and spiritual suffering of the terminally ill and let them die with dignity. Darren Taylor reports in the first part of a series focusing on palliative caregivers in South Africa.
To reach the mining town of Krugersdorp requires a journey through an industrial wasteland west of Johannesburg, past charismatic churches, sex shops, pawn shops, liquor stores, and fish and chip takeaways. The acidic aromas oozing from their doorways mix with smells of oil and petrol from scrapyards. Rian Venter is a palliative care specialist here at the West Gauteng Hospice.
We acknowledge that the person is fully alive until they actually physically die.
Fenter's a burly, silver-bearded man in his 50s. He's draped in a caftan striped with turquoise, tan, and purple fabric. Crystals are tied to his wrists. A candle burns in a corner of his office. Against a wall, a pile of fluffy toys teeters. Teddy bears, a stuffed lion, a monkey. Some of them belong to Fenter's young patients, children who are now dead. He held them before they died. His was the last face they saw. Water bubbles from a small fountain opposite. It's in this setting that Fenter breaks the news to patients.
In 1 week, I will have 4, 5, 8 sessions of telling people, looking them in the eye for the first time, saying, yes, you are going to die.
He says their first reaction is usually intense anger.
They've gone through many phases of treatment. They've been told, you're better now, you're cured. A while later they're told, well, actually the cancer is back now, and then your medical aid is depleted, and we're not going to be able to pay for this kind of treatment. It's not going to be worth it. We find incredible anger then.
A garden filled with flowers and birds surrounds Wits Hospice in the luxurious leafy suburb of Houghton in Johannesburg. Cameron Hogg, a psychologist, is spiritual counselor here. Hogg is bald with a goatee and piercing blue eyes. His wrists are decorated with elaborate bangles, his fingers imprisoned by thick gold rings. He emphasizes that he and the nurses he supervises aren't here to cure people.
The expectation of the patient, particularly if they no longer can walk, is I want to walk, I want to do, I want, I want, I want. We can't change the course of the disease. We cannot stop it happening. What we can do is support them to have a better experience.
Fenter says such bitterness and anger at the news of impending death is almost always followed by terror.
The deep fear inside is my ability to carry on when this total devastation is destroying my world as I know it.
Mashetu says the final stage her patients enter after hearing they'll soon be dead is questioning how they'll die.
Am I going to be able to breathe normally?
am I going to choke to death? Am I going to starve to death? Am I going to be dehydrated to death? Am I going to be in pain? Am I going to be aware of the process itself?
Jax, are you? Can I try and organize the colonoscopy for you?
Yes. Fenter and a doctor advise a cancer patient. The palliative specialist counsels his patients that if pain is managed, death is normal.
It's no different from being born. It's no different from having your 21st birthday party. You're having your last interaction. Today is your last day, and you can live it as full as you lived your first day of being sweet 16. There's no difference whatsoever. You're still alive, you're still here, and you're still now.
Fenter and Hogg agree there's a special moment when patients accept they're going to die and are at peace.
There's a new consciousness comes over the patient. There's a new physical look. And probably what we would call a surrender. So the person lets go of the roles they have held in life.
For some people, says Fenter, this moment never happens. Hogg says some patients refuse treatment, dying terrible, painful deaths.
There may be situations that we believe are horrific experiences for someone. If that is the correct journey for that soul, while it may not be ours and we may not be able to manage it, we have to honor that is what is in front of that patient. And that's what's important.
Behind Hogg, scrawled in red on a flip chart, are the words of American author Maya Angelou. I have learned that people forget what you said. People will forget what you did. But people will never forget how you made them feel. He says this is the mantra that palliative caregivers should live by. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
And a mobile computer lab powered by sunlight gives those in one of Nairobi's largest slum access to high technology and the world. Some of the more than 300,000 residents of Kawanguari survive on less than a dollar a day. The solar-powered portable lab and its 12 computers might change some of these Kenyans' lives. Lenny Ruvaga reports from Kawanguari.
Alan Midevo intently goes through the paces on a computer. The 20-year-old is among 20 students being taught basic computer skills. For nearly 3 months, Midevo has attended free daily lessons without fail. It's an opportunity he normally could not afford. His mother earns about $2 a day washing clothes. Similar training usually costs as much as $100 at more traditional learning institutions. Midevo says he only had to pay a one-time fee of $2.20 to show he was serious about studying.
The tutor is very friendly. He enables us to understand more. It's cost effective as it's only 200 shillings compared to the other colleges. And this project enables us to have computer skills.
Craft Silicon Foundation, a non-profit group, began offering free information and communication technology courses to underprivileged young people 5 years ago. The training takes 10 weeks. If students pass the final exam, they receive certificates of graduation. But this is no traditional class setting. It is in a bus with 12 computers powered by solar panels. This $100,000 mobile computer lab has helped close to 7,000 students. Craft Silicon is a global financial software company with offices in Kenya, Tanzania, India, and the United States. CEO Kamal Budhapati says it promotes computer literacy as part of its corporate philosophy of social responsibility.
Education is still a luxury at some of these slums. So we believe that as much as it is so important, we must go to slum areas where they cannot afford to get technological education.
The Kenyan government also plans to increase internet literacy and access to information by providing free internet in 2015 to all the informal settlements in Nairobi. For now, these students from Kawanguari look forward to completing their course and working to better their future. Lenny Mubaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yais Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer Bill Workinger and our engineer Greg Burns, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Paul Simon Water for the World Act of 2014, enacted in mid-December by the U.S. Congress, aims to strengthen implementation of the Paul Simon Water for the Poor Act of 2005 by improving the capacity of the U.S. government to implement, monitor, and evaluate programs to provide first-time or improved access to safe drinking water, sanitation, and hygiene to the world's poorest on an equitable and sustainable basis, according to the law's preamble. The 2005 law made access to safe water and sanitation for developing countries a specific policy objective of the U.S. Foreign Assistance Program. The act was named after the late Senator Paul Simon, who authored a book entitled Tapped Out that warned of the world's looming clean water crisis. We need to make every dollar of our limited foreign aid resources count by addressing problems where we can have a real impact on people's lives, said Senator Bob Corker, member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and a sponsor of the 2014 law. The law's aims are to ensure water, sanitation, and hygiene, or WASH funding, remains a U.S. foreign policy priority, sharpen the criteria for selecting high-priority countries and communities for receiving WASH service, increase integration of WASH programs with other critical interventions, including child survival, global health, food security and nutrition, and gender equality to increase program effectiveness, advance best practices for effective aid, including public-private partnerships, and improve the United States' strategic approach to safe water, sanitation, and hygiene within the context of broader efforts to promote sound water resources management. Rajiv Shah, the administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, hailed the law's passage as a boon to U.S. and international efforts to provide clean water and sanitation services to 2.5 billion people who do not have access to basic sanitation and 750 million people who lack access to clean water. The Act, Administrator Shah noted, provides a solid platform for USAID to work toward our goal of a water-secure future, free from diseases caused from inadequate access to clean water and sanitation, where food is available and affordable, and where populations are less vulnerable to the risks of a changing planet.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, this is Sunday Shomari. Join me every Monday for your lighthearted show, Let's Talk. Right, Monday at 17:30 UTC for interviews, great music, and a whole lot of laughter. Right here at the VOA Africa. Keep it locked.
VOAAfrica.net. Don't miss.